So Let Ted Ride was a very cool and heartwarming show of support from racers, from you know, folks who, like Lance Armstrong, was he called me that night and said, "Hey, do you want me to try to fight this for you?" It was wild. And all said and done, I think largely because I don't have a French passport, I was cordially asked to leave.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
What's going on, you beautiful roadmen? Welcome back to the Roadman Podcast. The feedback to that last episode with Tyler Hamilton was insane. If you haven't checked out the Tyler Hamilton episode, it's the one just before that. It's totally worth going back to listen to. Like him, load him, love him. You can't but admire the openness, the transparency, and the honesty. And yeah, he opened up on the podcast, and yeah, it was brilliant to be a part of it. Today's guest, I'm so excited about. I unapologetically will call him the King of Gravel, Ted King. He's had a glamorous, glitzing pro tour career before making the step over to off-road. And I think now he's a part of something that's very important. He's a part of the move from cycling from an elite sport where we win at all costs to a participatory sport, much like the transition that running went through in the 1980s when they transitioned from track and field to the mass participation marathons. And I think events like Dirty Kanza, Leadville, Ted is right at the forefront of this transition. It's a super interesting chat from a very interesting, funny, and articulate guy. So I'm looking forward to bringing you that. Before I do, I'd encourage you to jump on over to our Patreon account. It's Patreon, patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. The Patreon account, the idea of it is, if you're enjoying this content, it's your way to just say, you know what, I enjoyed the content, I'd like to buy you a coffee, I'd buy you a beer. And for me, what it does is it helps me keep getting these guests, it helped me cover the costs of running this podcast, and it just helps this whole ecosystem grow. So jump on over to patreon.com and check that out. It would be much appreciated. Without any further ado, let's jump into it. So, Ted King, welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
This is awesome. Thank you very much for having me.
Ted, I'm looking forward to just talking some random cycling stuff with you today.
Sure, yeah. That sounds like my life in so many words, is a whole lot of random cycling.
It's a good way to describe gravel cycling, but I don't even want to start a gravel cycling. I want to just start, throw back a little bit to the first time. I'm a bit of a cycling anorak, but I suppose I'm not enough of a cycle anorak that I'd know every domestique in the peloton back in the day anyway. You know, I couldn't tell you who, you know, sixth or seventh domestique is for Quickstep at the moment. You know, I know the highlight stuff, but
sure.
You first came to my attention. I was a struggling Conti rider in the US, and I was recovering from an injury, and I was on the couch in Toronto, and I was looking at Twitter, and I seen trending, "Let Ted Ride." And I was like, what the hell is this Let Ted Ride? Do you want to start there and tell us what that was?
Sure. So that would have been July of 2013. I was at my first Tour de France, and I was teammates with Peter Sagan. We were going into stage one, trying to put him in the jersey in a sprint stage. Ended up breaking myself, in so many words. What did I do? I broke my scapula. I had road rash all over. I ended up, what did I do? Broke a handful of ribs. Anyway, so totally messed up. Any other race in the world, I would have gone home. But being that this is my first tour, I soldiered on as best I could. Get up to stage four was a team time trial in Nice. And given the extent of my injuries, I couldn't get into a traditional time trial position. My shoulder was totally wrecked. So for better or worse, I did the team time trial on a road bike with clip-ons.
Actually, I remember that.
Oh, freaking brutal. And I mean, it's so, the odds were so horribly against me. Like, it was, we call it a 30K time trial. And the first 800 meters were through downtown Nice, and the rest was just wide open, like full gas, you know, 0% technical. Got dropped straight out of the gate because I can't stand it. I can't sprint. Ended up doing the whole team time trial on a road bike at 28 miles an hour, which I was, in hindsight, quite pleased with.
That's pretty good.
But, you know, long story short, I get through the finish line. Orica Green Edge sets the Tour de France fastest ever team time trial time, thereby, because of the percentage of the winner's time cut, I'm time cut from the Tour de France by about 7 seconds.
It's like 25% or something, TTT,
is yeah, it? Something like that. So Let Ted Ride was a very cool and heartwarming show of support from racers, from you know, folks who, like Lance Armstrong, was he called me that night and said, hey, do you want me to try to fight this for you? It was wild. And all said and done, I think largely because I don't have a French passport, I was cordially asked to leave.
It's the problem with those discretionary rules, isn't it? Where, you know, you see it all the time in the tour, the hometown decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's love it and hate it, you know? It makes the sport so cool. And then when it's cruel and the rules are against you, it's a real bummer.
Any regrets on that period of your life, World Tour, how it all came to an end?
I mean, I continued to race from there. That particular anecdote was certainly painful. It was tough for a variety of reasons. My dad had a stroke in 2003, and getting to Europe has been difficult. My mom is my dad's caregiver. I mean, he's severely physically handicapped. He is. So, you know, it's tough for them to get to Europe. They came to that race, which was the first and only European race they ever came to. So it was ironic that they had skipped the first 3 days because they were in Sardinia. The race was in Sardinia Corsica. And so they came to Nice the day that I was asked to leave, which just, you know, that's insult to injury.
I saw this. Was it like, was there like a US TV crew filmed you?
Yeah.
And you're just like crestfallen, like can barely put words together.
Good memory. Yeah, it was awful. I mean, sitting down to the interview, I didn't think I was going to be so shaken up. And, you know, they basically say like, hey, Ted, can you walk us through it? And, you know, just so many emotions come out because of the support my parents have had in my career. And there they are that I can't race. And I remember telling them in the interview before it started, like, hey, if I start crying, like, can we just cut? But of course, that's pure Hollywood gold. So.
Because I was on the couch, I'd came down at a bunch sprint. I was never a sprinter, but my team didn't turn up to, I don't know, some crit in Detroit or something. So I was coming from Toronto, they were coming from Chicago, and they had problems. So I ended up just getting to sit on the back of the healthcare train thinking I was a bit of a sprinter. And
yeah,
done this on a Saturday, I think. I was like, easy prize money. All I was doing was following the lead out man and like wasn't even sprinting and making prize money. And I was like, I'll do that again on the Sunday, and massive bunch sprint crash. And I broke my collarbone, scapula, ribs. And I was sitting on the couch in Toronto, like all my bones broke watching this interview with you. And I was thinking, that poor cunt.
Yeah. Oh, it sucked, man.
From there to the end of your World Tour career, we'll call it career part one. Any regrets with how it panned out?
No. I mean, you know, I raced 10 years professionally, three in the U.S. domestic scene, and you know, everything, my entire career, I got into the sport of cycling late, and my whole career just sort of was a door opening, and I jumped through it. Very little expectation. So, you know, when I had the offer to go to Europe, I said, wow, this is huge. Let's go do that.
You know, your career was so cool, like from Bissell to Cervelo, a team which, you know, was probably light years ahead of it was at the time. And I don't want to gloss over all that, but I can nearly do a 3-hour podcast with you. I want to get into the juicy gravel stuff.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to get a flavor of like that last sort of year of your career. Are you still fighting for contracts, or are you still kind of thinking, you know, time's running up on this one?
No, I mean, I felt content knowing that I could continue to race. So like I was saying, I raced for 10 years pro, 7 in Europe. And then there I am early in 2015, and I'm looking around at that point. We were Cannondale Garmin, or Garmin Cannondale, whichever sponsor order it was. And I was the third oldest person on the team. We're a super young team. I'm looking around. I'm like, I'm only 32 years old, thinking, you know, how long do I want to do this? I got teammates who are out here who are 38, 39. Could I do this for another 10 years? Do I want to? And then at like a 35,000 foot level, I'm thinking, okay, I'm single. It's really difficult to like settle down and find a American spouse when only, and not that I'm trying to find an American spouse, but if I'm only in America for a couple weeks a year and then I'm just globetrotting the rest of the time, like, when do I actually settle down?
But isn't this the part no one sees? Like, and your dad's at home sick as well. Everyone thinks they're always sporting decisions.
Oh, totally. It's a total goofy mix. So sorry, to cut to the chase, I felt content and I could continue to race, but I wanted to wrap up my professional career, happy about cycling, so I, you know, just basically with still with a smile on my face and proud of what I'm doing, instead of getting to the November and not having a contract and thinking, well, shoot, I guess this is my retirement. So I talked to some close friends and family and confidants, and I said, you know, this is going to be my last year. I announced it right before Tour California, and it made for a really cool final year at 2015. Like, you know, red carpet rolled out whenever we went to an event. Really cool way to say goodbye to pro cycling.
It's a really nice way to finish it off. I chatted to Steve Cummings, and he had the exact opposite experience, where he was going to tour of Britain thinking, you know what, I'm in the shape of my life, 38 years old, I think, at the time, but thinking, if I put on a show in Tour of Britain, I can definitely get a contract for next year. And then he crashed on like stage two of Tour of Britain or something.
Yeah. Which is nuts. Like, Steve Cummings, come on, man. Like, he should be... But, you know, you should have contract offers left, right, and center.
Well, this is what I was thinking. I was saying to him, I was like, Steve, how are you going to tour of Britain? Like, the last chance saloon. It's like, you know, it's 10 to 3 a.m. in the nightclub there, and you're looking around looking for a girl. Yeah. Like, I was like, how is this happening, Steve Cummins? Like, they have 10, 15 years of data on you. They know. Like, you've won two Tour de France stages.
Bike racing, man. It's crazy.
Short memories. So... that period then, from your sort of your finishing lap where everyone knows you're finishing up, it's, you know, high fives all around. In your head, are you thinking, you know what, this is my career over? Or are you thinking, you know what, this is the start of something really cool? Did you have that eye on gravel at the time?
No, absolutely not. It was very much the former. It was, I'm something of a rarity in the world tour in that I have a college degree, and certainly.
Oh yeah, what have you got?
I studied economics and math, and
nice.
It's not, you know, there are no guarantees with that. However, there is something that does make you different, among the world tour. So, you know, I half expected to go to Wall Street because that's what most people who with my degree from the school that I went to do post college. I, of course, occupied the next 10 years with bike racing. So, you know, who knows? I was thinking in some capacity I would end up in the finance world. But as time evolved in 2015, a couple longtime sponsors of the teams that I had been on said, hey, you know, there is bike riding beyond bike racing. We'd be interested in working with you. Do you want to pursue that? So, you know, first and foremost, that was Cannondale. I'd ridden on Cannondale bikes for the previous 5 years, and the term ambassador is I think overused. I don't know.
Yeah, it's every Instagram influencer now that gets a free set of sunglasses, an ambassador. Uh-huh.
So it's goofy. Like I loathe the word, but there is something to be said about that is what they were, you know, basically offering to me. So using that as a foundation, you know, picked up a handful of other meaningful partners, you know, companies that I, instead of like being on a pro team and being forced to use product X, Y, and Z, to actually go and proactively choose the companies that I wanted to work with. Because at that point, like ambassador and especially this gravel racing thing was non-existent. I mean, even in 2015, like the term gravel was next to non-existent.
I did never a heard it in 2015.
Exactly. I did this independent of the pandemic in which we're in. There is a cycling, what do they call it? It was like a digital worldwide conference. So instead of being at Eurobike or Interbike, it was an online platform. And I was brought on as a presenter. And so, of course, naturally, I did my presentation on gravel. And I ended up getting some really cool stats from some event registration sites, and speaking to this exact point, like the term gravel was used in 2% of search terms in 2014 for events, and now it's like, you know, 40% of cycling events in North America. So
are you getting free, not to delve too much into your personal financial situation and tell me to piss off if you want, like, how difficult is it to get cash out of these sponsors at the time for something that, like, is completely unproven?
It was easier than getting blood from a rock, is a funny expression that somebody used recently. I have an agent, Joao Correa. He has been my agent for my final 3 years racing. We were teammates on the Cervelo test team. He's a longtime friend and trusted confidant. He continues to work with me in retirement, and he represents, you know, the current champion, Mads Pedersen. They have a huge cadre of not huge. They have a tight list of incredible riders who are all in, like, a, you know, the young mid 20s. And then the only people they represent outside of who are retired are myself and Jens Voigt. So, you know, that's pretty decent company to be in.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, he does the talking, he does the negotiating. I guess in short, it's easier said than done to make a living out of it. No one sponsor could support what I'm doing, but, you know, collectively it makes for a pretty decent income.
But it's funny when you say retired, mm-hmm. like, it's for me as a cycling fan looking in from the outside, I almost see your role now in the formative years of gravel and the public awareness of gravel as being way more important than your role of Shepherd and Sagan back then. Because for me, gravel is accessible. You know, the clients we're working with, like, you know, 50 years old, 10, 15 kilos overweight, I can go and tell them to go and do Dirty Kansas. Like, we've clients that went and done Dirty Kansas last year, mm-hmm. and they see you there and they're riding with you. Like, they can't go and do the Critérium de Dauphiné with you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like watching, I think I was in my last podcast with Steve Cummings, where we were saying, like, the World Tour, it's just like watching Avengers. Like, it doesn't seem real.
Uh-huh. No, and I think that's just exacerbating. Like, you know, you and I have recently talked to Ian Boswell. He's a neighbor up here, so to speak.
Good guy.
And he's, you know, he wrapped it up last year, so he's closer to the World Tour than I am, now 5 years removed. And I mean, even he is saying it's that much more cutthroat, and, like, you know, guys are using ketones day in and day out, and everybody's in the wind tunnel, and everybody's looking for, like, marginal gains. So, yeah, the World Tour is just in a league of its own right now. Gravel is that tangible part of cycling. And I guess, you know, not to gloss over when I was in the World Tour, like, it was cutthroat, and it's intervals all day, every day. And it's, you know, you train hard and you recover easy, and you pay attention to every little aspect of life. So you just live cycling 24/7. That is the lifestyle that I retired from. Whereas now, gravel, as much as it is a racing career, so to speak, it's fun. It's a beer after the race. It is talking during the race. It is, you know, I use a hackneyed term, it's just it is all about the community, which is so cool in the grand scheme of things.
Do you ride your bike every day?
It's pissing rain right now, so I won't be riding today. Yeah, I mean, I that's what's nice too, right? Like, I ride when I want to ride. I don't ride when I don't want to ride. Yeah, I ride a freaking boatload, and it's truly because I love riding a bike.
You still have a coach and use performance management charts and TSS and monitor stuff like this?
Absolutely not.
No.
You know, which is ironic, because I have a very small coaching business. I coach half dozen athletes, and, you know, there's funny contracts, because I'm imparting the knowledge that I've gained over my career, and I know the value of having a coach, but I most certainly do not have one myself.
Yeah, but it's like that if I go riding with a client or something, you know, you're telling them to make sure you eat every 20 minutes, and they're like, well, you haven't mm-hmm. eaten in 3.5 hours. And you're like, you're like, look, listen, just do what I say, not what I do.
Exactly. Well said.
The gravel races, some of them are just crazy epic. And I know there's a bunch of people listening now, and they're like, they don't know. Like, look, we know Roubaix, Flanders, Flesh alone. We know the classics, you know, the must watch ones, the must go and see ones. What's the must go and see or the must do races in gravel?
You know, Dirty Kansas certainly implanted itself as like the granddaddy of gravel races. You know, and it's funny because it's not 20 years old. It's probably 14, 15 years old now. But it's just grown so exponentially. So starting with 34 people now at, you know, 3,400 or something.
That's crazy on the start line with 3,400 dudes though.
It is. It's wild. Like, you know, when you're starting in these small towns, Dirty Kansas especially, and like to think of how many people are lined up throughout the course, and how many people are snaking throughout the 200 miles or 100 or 50 miles. It is wild.
When you line up on like a Cat 1 criterium or a Pro criterium or a Pro Kermesse or whatever, you at least know that the people around you have the same skill, fitness, proficiency ballpark that you have. Like, you're not going to get some wild Cat 4 in a Pro Kermesse in Belgium.
Sure.
Is that a worry that you're coming flying down into the fourth section and you're like, this dude was on his fourth sportif?
No, I don't worry about it at all. And certainly there are dangers in gravel, but having come from, you know, racing a classics schedule year in and year out, like, that's dangerous. I always called it square peg round hole. Like, when you try to put 200 people on a goat path that's 8 feet wide and everybody wants to be in the first two rows, like, that's dangerous racing. Racing gravel, you know, which are speeds considerably lower, and I don't know, you're able to shake it out so that you're in the group that you're meant to be in very quickly. You can shake people when you want to shake them, and chances are if they're dangerous in front of you, you say, okay, I'm going to move around this guy.
Yeah. How interesting is Ted King? Let's just take a collective exhalation and relax for a minute and just reset. Take your phone out and head on over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. If you're enjoying the podcast, if you're loving this content, that's the way to just say, you know what, if we were hanging out together, I'd buy you a beer for facilitating these stories. That's the way you say thanks, and that's the way you keep this content coming week after week. Now, let's get back to the show and more from Ted King. What do you make of the kind of trend of the World Tour boys coming over to gravel?
There's a good part of it that does grit at me, and you know, I can appreciate anyone calling a kettle black here and saying I'm doing the same thing. What I did in 2016, on a whim, I was asked to do Dirty Kansas in 2016, and I did it, and I was like, oh man, this is super cool, and I appreciated the whether you finish first or last or anything in between, like, there is a party atmosphere, and that's a blast. It's not doing intervals. It's not training the way I used to train. It's not focusing on diet and you know, FTP tests. And I'm not promoting alcohol consumption. But yeah, like, have a freaking beer at the end of the race. And you know what? Have a beer in the middle of the race if someone presents it to you. So it's... World Tour riders are so much a league of their own. So if they retire and come on over, that's cool. To put some of these gravel races in the middle of their race calendar when they're, you know, fresh off Paris-Nice and getting ready for the Tour de France, and they're going to try to do some gravel, and if they are going to start duking it out, then like, all they're doing is proving that they're stronger than everybody else, which we know in the first place. And so in a way, it's almost like a lose-lose. Or, I mean, I shouldn't say that because I don't want to sound like such a hater. Like, it is awesome to bring more attention to gravel. It's really cool to be able to line up with these pros who are, in 2-3 weeks, lining up to the Tour de France. However, if they are going to make it cutthroat, like, we could have very easily seen that last year's Dirty Kansas, an entire World Tour podium. And it's just like, well, yeah, we get it. So it was, that's what made it super cool to see Colin Strickland win DK last year.
Well, for as a spectator, me, that's what's quite annoying. Like, I don't know the guys, and I'm sure they're lovely guys, like the EF boys that turn up. But it's more, when I think about gravel, I think about something that's countercultural. and mm-hmm. there's something a little bit edgy there. It's something not playing by the rules. Like, fucking throw on aero bars in the middle of a bunch race. Like, do what the fuck you want. Stop.
Yeah.
Drink beers. Do what you want. Bring your phone in your pocket. Mm-hmm. And then the World Tour boys are the exact antithesis of that. Like, it's like, yeah. how far is your seat post behind your bottom bracket, your saddle right. tip? It's like, fuck off.
Right. Sock height. And you know, the riders in the World Tour don't want those, all of those rules. They don't care about sock height. They don't care about how many, you know, centimeters your saddle is from your bottom bracket. And that is part of the lure and part of the invitation, part of the fun of gravel. And so they can, you know, escape for a weekend or a day or whatever it is. Again, if you're just proving it as a fitness contest, like, we get it. You're fitter than us.
Are we moving towards more structure from the gravel organizers? Do they have to structure this stuff now?
That's a really tough question. My wife and I have an event. We have an event the first weekend in August. Last year was the first year. It's called Rooted Vermont, and we're in the same boat. You know, how do you accept teams? Like, if a team of 8 pro riders shows up, like, that's sort of a bummer. On the same time, like, you want teams and you want notoriety and you want fast people and you want a lot of the things that have both a positive and negative. There are certain things that I am against. For example, I am against aero bars for a variety of reasons that we don't need to get into. Like, I don't want to see aero bars in an event. I love how a lot of gravel events have adopt their own rules to make it fit their event. But the first rule in gravel is often don't be lame. So it just, you know, it leaves the onus on the rider. Like, you don't want to do something that's going to leave you to be like this, you know, socially ostracized person from the gravel scene because you made a dumb decision.
And so, that's kind of how I feel about the aero bars. Like,
yeah,
you obviously totally. They're faster. We all know they're faster. Like, we don't need to go into the wind tunnel on a gravel road to know that. Like, but you 100%. Just look like such a dick using them.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like, a time trial and a team time trial are so inexplicably awful. So, like, let that be where aero bars live and let gravel be the fun, comfortable part of the sport.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. But say you have, like, I say I don't mean to pry, but I do mean to pry. You can tell me to piss off otherwise. What's the prize money like for winning a Dirty Kanza?
Approximately $0.
Okay.
There are a handful of events that have prize money. So Dirty Kanza does a belt buckle, you know, and it's priceless. It's one of a kind. It's handmade. It's super cool. Cowboy hats, bottles of beer, bottles of local hooch, bottles of wine are common. Cowboy hats are very cool. You know, honestly, I think racing for art that's one of a kind is as cool as anything.
Honestly, I think that's a great move as well, because where I was going with that was like, you know what, if there's $5,000, $10,000 prize for winning mm-hmm. Dirty Kanza, like, then mm-hmm. do we need to start scanning bikes for hidden motors? Do we need to start dope control all over the place?
It's a can of worms that I don't know what we open up. Yeah, it's a really good question. There are events that do have prize money, and you know what I say is, like, I will never say no to a check if I'm lucky enough to be on the podium and take home a check. But I'm also perfectly happy without prize money in gravel. It does make it hyper competitive to a degree that makes me a little bit anxious. Yeah, we're in a very formative part of gravel now. And, you know, what we see this year is going to be different than next year. It's going to be different than 10 years from now. So we want to keep the good parts great. And we want to basically eliminate the parts that are going to bring the sport down.
Well, it's even like, I'm not sure how I feel about, well, actually forget how I feel. How do you feel about the Wahoo Frontiers, Tim?
I like the people on the team for
that's dodging the question.
And I shouldn't even say that. I love the people on the team. I love the people who are coming to gravel. Teams in general make me anxious, but I also just don't get it, because, like, if you have multiple people on it, like, I want to win a race. I can never picture myself being on a team, because as much as team components are a huge part of traditional road racing, like, call me selfish, I want to be on the podium. So I wouldn't necessarily want to be on a team where I want my teammate on the podium. Like, I want to win, and everybody who I'm duking it out with week in and week out at these gravel races, they want to win. So, and I think, and that extends to your question, like, if Pete and Ian are in a race together, they're racing against each other.
Yeah, but are they? Because we've seen Alex Howes and Lachlan last year, and they're doing their world tour thing, trading off on the front. And I went to throw a beer at the TV. I was like, fuck off.
Right. No, I mean, that's a really good point, really good topic. Like, I think for those guys, coming to Leadville, coming to Dirty Kansas last year, like, they are purely having fun, because that is, it's a way to escape amid an otherwise very frantic world tour schedule. Dot, dot, dot. I don't know. Yeah, teams do make me anxious in the grand scheme of gravel.
Let's change gear a little bit. Something when I was researching the podcast, which I didn't know about you, you have your own nutrition company.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know.
Brilliant.
You don't sell it over here in Ireland.
No, international distribution is something that we're investigating. We have, actually, in your neck of the woods, Ireland and the UK is where we have most of our inquiries about where people can get it. So we are, the company's called Untapped. We are based in maple syrup. So as opposed to brown rice syrup or maltodextrin or you know, a laundry list of really cheap, crappy sugars that are the base of 99% of sports nutrition, maple syrup is a categorical superfood. It has all of the macronutrients that you're looking for in sports nutrition. And then from there, we only use real ingredients. So we're never going to use natural flavors. You're never going to use artificial flavors. You purely use the real thing. So, like, we wanted a caffeinated maple product, so we purely put coffee into maple syrup. It is out of this world. It's a cool story the way it started. Because I'm from New England, where maple syrup is native here in the United States, people knew me back in the day when Twitter was the largest form of social media as the maple syrup guy. So I would, like, literally step off the bus at the Giro or Paris-Nice or the Spring Classics, and people would hand me small bottles of maple syrup.
That's cool.
Which is freaking amazing. I mean, it's, like, expensive to ship. It's expensive to buy in Europe in the first place. So I would, you know, be home at training, and I would take a nip of maple syrup before a ride or during a ride or after a ride, and then take a gel on the ride. And I'm thinking to myself, why am I taking this gel that I don't like mid-ride when I'm gulping the maple syrup after the ride, and they're both sugars? Like, there's got to be a solution here. So did a little bit of research, tried to start a company for a couple of years that didn't work, but then a mutual friend of mine and ultimately my business partners said, hey, you got to talk to the Cochrans. The Cochrans are this family of Olympic alpine skiers who are producing maple syrup.
So it's not O.J. Simpson's lawyer.
No. Oh,
if the glove don't fit, you must have quit.
Started this company Untapped. So we're selling maple syrup.
You know, I was giving a club talk, that was a few months ago, and after the club talk, I got an email off Power Bar. And they were basically giving out shit to me because I was saying, like, don't eat this crap. I was like, if you can't pronounce the stuff on the back of the label, I was like, and I had a Power Bar gel, and I was like, read the ingredients on the back of this. This word has 42 letters in it. It's not a real word. I was like, they give that to astronauts. Like, it's not real food. Like, we don't have to eat that. And I've actually been looking for something. This sounds like a mad, it's full sponsored podcast from Untapped here, but this was
this is
unplanned.
Perfect.
I only actually stumbled across it. I think it was a Belgian waffle clip or something I seen on YouTube.
Yeah, Stroop waffle. I mean, same thing. Like, I would have a Stroop waffle and I'm racing the classics in Belgium, and you think, okay, this is good. You flip it over and you see all these ingredients that really don't make sense. And even, like, the word natural flavors, there's nothing natural about it. So here in the United States, if you're going to put anything on your waffle, you put maple syrup on your waffle. It is delicious. It is amazing. So every time I'd have a Stroop waffle, I'm like, why is this butter flavored?
See, I lived in Canada for a while.
There you go. Exactly.
Yeah, like I'm addicted to the shit.
Oh, it's so good. So we made the only stroopwafel that is sweetened exclusively with maple syrup. We got a coffee, a lemon, a chai, raspberry, and then we use only the real ingredient, real chai spices, real coffee, real raspberries, real lemon. It is out of this world. Okay. And then, I mean, go back to your point of like these non-pronounceable ingredient lists. Even the word citric acid, the term citric acid is in so much food in the United States, and it's often in leavened flavored items. But people don't realize that citric acid as an ingredient is derived from corn. It's fermented corn, has the flavor of lemons, and that is put into lemon flavored foods because it's cheap and people think it's lemons.
Yeah, I just don't trust stuff that bacteria doesn't eat. Like if you can leave it there and the bacteria doesn't even eat it, like, you know, I don't want to eat that shit.
Correct.
Talk to me about nutrition and the lockdown. I'm not sure, are you in full lockdown mode over there?
We are largely locked down. We're in a very, very rural part of the States, so we can get out, we can go ride. But yeah, no communal gatherings and so forth.
Yeah. We're like prisoners over here at the moment. So everyone is full gas on Zwift. Uh-huh. So when I finish any sort of session on Zwift, I have a puddle of sweat like you wouldn't believe leaking down. I live in an apartment, shop is below. I can only imagine there's people getting doused in my sweat as they're queuing for their groceries.
Oh, that's foul. Nice.
what are we thinking electrolyte replacement on these indoor sessions? Should it change from outdoor?
Man, that is a good question. I mean, I don't nerd out on the science of electrolyte replacement. I'm in the same boat. I'm riding indoors, I don't know, once, twice a week, and I sweat profusely. I consume more hydration. Untapped, of course, does have a hydration component. We have a drink called Maplade. So, you know, over the course of an hour ride, I'll probably drink a bottle and a half, whereas because it's still cool outside, if I'm going to go ride outside, a bottle and a half would probably take me 3 hours to consume.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I've just always been about like the macro of nutrients, of consumption, of nutrition. Like, yeah, you're sweating more than normal. Okay, then you should probably consume more than normal.
Yeah, you wouldn't completely nerd out and be weighing yourself pre-session, weighing your fluid, weighing yourself post-session.
That's a chance.
It's a world tour thing, is it?
It's a world tour thing.
Someone's getting into gravel at the moment. I've bunches of clients at the moment and they're getting into gravel. And one of the questions I'm getting all the time, and I love gravel and I love the idea, and I take my road bike off riding off crazy trails all the time, but I haven't got a gravel specific bike at the moment. So this question is largely for me as well. What's the good starter getting into gravel bike?
I've spent a lot of time over the years on the Cannondale Super X, which is, you know, originally it was designed for cyclocross. It's a cyclocross race bike. It's super light. It's got enormous clearance. And I think Cannondale has always really done a good job of creating bikes with big clearance. Like my first road bike in retirement was, it was 2016. It was a disc road bike and I could fit 32s on that, which
that's
large for a road bike 5 years ago. And then, yeah, extrapolate that to a cyclocross bike where you can easily put on 38s, 40s, 42s. Wider the tire that you can put on a bike, you know, basically the more capable it's going to be.
Is carbon as important?
Hit or miss. I mean, there are plenty of great aluminum bikes. So frame material is less important. I would go back. The two things that I always hit on are wider tires and then wider gear ranges. So, yeah, when you're going up some crazy steep embankment, like the gearing has been so opened up, like SRAM Eagle with a 1050 rear. Like,
it's just crazy.
It's so gnarly. And then with a wide tire, you have such grip on the ground that you can be going at just like glacial speeds, but you can still make it up these basically previously impossible pitches.
And what's the one boy performing like? I know, but the Irish Pro Team Aqua Blue Sport. My buddy was the director sportif for that, and they rode the one boy with, was it 3T's bike at the time, on the road, and they fucking hated it. Like, they they dropped their chains so much.
No kidding.
Yeah, I don't know if, what chain catcher setup they were using there, but yeah, they hated it.
That's hilarious. No, like, I mean, it's especially ironic because we're riding way, way, way rougher roads, and I can't think of a single time, especially on a one by, that I've dropped a chain. I don't know if it's the clutch. One potential difference is the clutch, or the tension that a rear derailleur could put with such a huge gear range, could provide enough tension that a road gearing would not necessarily have, because you do need a wider range that you're going to have on a gravel bike than you would on a road bike.
When I said you were coming on the podcast to a couple of people, everyone's like, the number one question, I'm sure you're fed up asking it, is tire choices. And just because so many people asked it, I don't even want you to mention tire choices. Uh-huh. I'm like, fuck off. It's like, if you're riding down a road, use a fucking narrow set of tires. If you're riding in some gnarly shit, use some gnarly tires.
That conveniently is the exact answer that I do give. So let's make it sponsor compliant. I'm sponsored by a company called Renee Harris, H-E-R-S-E. And depending on how adept you are at linking things, I have a blog that based on their website that basically describes this exact thing. But their tire choices are so simple. They have a huge range of slick tires, so as wide as like 55C and as narrow as 28. And then they have one tread pattern for everything else in a variety of widths. So it goes back to my point, like, wider is better. So basically put the widest tire you can on your bike. And then if you're riding wet, muddy, snowy, gnarly stuff, then you have tread. If you're going to ride something that doesn't necessarily require tread, then just do this, the widest slick you can.
Yeah, if you ping me a link in a DM or something to it, I'll stick it into the show notes and people can geek out on it.
People geek out all day. Perfect. I like it.
Just to get to the broader ones, do you think you'll always cycle? Does it contribute to your happiness?
Yeah, it definitely does. I've pondered, like, if cycling was taken away from me, and I think this in the context of my dad having a stroke and so many things being torn away from him, and he still exudes this incredible positivity that he has every right in the world to be angry and bitter and down about. I try to think that I could have the same perspective. I mean, cycling has given me a job, a life, the past 15 years of my life, a spouse, the roof over my head.
Ah, you found a girl.
Found a girl. Yeah,
is she American?
Conveniently, or coincidentally, I should say, she rides a bike, so she understands my infatuation with the sport. Nice. Yeah, American girl.
How'd you meet her?
On a bike ride. Mutual friend's birthday party, and it was a bike riding food goblin party, and
food goblin
inseparable ever since. Yeah,
it's the only goblin.
I don't know how. I know I could operate without the bike in my life. I just prefer to not picture that world.
What's your day look like at the moment?
Just any day in particular?
Yeah, just a normal day.
So we have a 1 month and 13 day old child. Month and a half old child.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Laura will wake up 2-3 times in the night to feed little baby Hazel, leaving me to sleep pretty soundly through the night, so that come 5 in the morning when Hazel's waking up and starting to stir, I'm downstairs at probably 5 a.m. Taking care of Hazel for a couple hours. Then start banging out emails. Untapped is a huge part of what I do. Doing a whole lot of the marketing and athlete relationships and content creation and communication and emails, that largely falls in my lap. Interacting with sponsors probably now more than ever, so that, you know, amid a year or a season that might not happen, basically making sure that sponsors are happy with the stuff that I'm doing and creating and talking about and producing. Check the weather, because we got some Irish-like weather here every now and again. So, you know, find that nice window of time to get out on the bike. And if it's a short day, then spend some time on the trainer indoors. And food is a very important aspect of life here. So come 5 o'clock, it's time for happy hour with the wife, and start settling down and create some sort of meal. And I'm absolutely exhausted by the time Hazel's going to bed at 8:30, and I'm usually going to bed soon thereafter.
You're kind of plugging off social media and stuff after 5 o'clock?
I try to unplug. I'm probably as guilty as anyone of you know, continuing flipping through some feed. I feel like, I don't know if it's selfish, I feel like I'm a producer of content rather than a consumer. Like, I actually don't scroll through all that often, so it's more like the churn of me thinking of the next thing I need to produce, or the next story I want to tell, or the next blog I want to write, or so forth.
Oh, I'm the exact same. So I have a YouTube channel that I started. I kind of had it for a while, but there was nothing really going on it. So I started at New Year. I said, you know what, I'm going to put my head down on YouTube. But now I'm kind of like you on that. My girlfriend would be saying, like, why are you watching so much YouTube? And I'm actually not watching it with a consumer's mindset. I'm watching it with a producer's mindset, going, oh shit, that's a cool shot angle, or that's a good idea. For you have a YouTube channel as well, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, now more than ever is that content creation. Last year, a very good friend of mine, Ansel Dickey, who's a former pro cyclist turned market maven, he said, hey, I got a camera, I can shoot some content. Which sounds ridiculous, and I hate to keep on using the word content. He has the most tremendous eye for both seeing an event and seeing a race, and then putting it to a film. So we've created this series of races. He came to probably a half dozen races last year, and you know, it's capturing what the whole weekend is about. The race is definitely a big aspect of it, but you know, seeing like the travel logistics or the family logistics, or you know, how to find a good coffee shop, just the most basic stuff.
Yeah, I was going to ask, your production quality is very good, because I'm up, my channel's way smaller than yours. I'm up at like, I think close to 8,000 subs or something now, but I'm doing a lot of it myself. I'm going more like rugged vlog style. And it's hard. Like, it's time consuming.
Oh my God, it's so time consuming. Yeah, I mean, quick plug, it's called King of the Ride. And then I completely empathize with you, because amid this lockdown, I have a podcast as well. Traditionally, always, it's done face-to-face, except now we can't do face-to-face stuff, so it's over the screen. As a result of that, I'm doing video casts, and I'm doing all the editing for the video cast, and my God, that's a lot of work.
See, and you know what, the funny thing is, we've been chatting for, 50 minutes or something now, and it's taken us 50 minutes to do this. Can you imagine if we produced a 50-minute YouTube video? It would take us 6 months.
It would take 3 months. Exactly.
It'd be insane. Ted, where's the best place for people to follow you?
I am all things at I Am Ted King. So I Am Ted King.com. I Am Ted King on the Twitter, the Facebook, the Instagram, and then also King of the Ride on YouTube.
And Untapped.
And untapped.cc. Here in the United States, and probably over across the world and throughout Europe and the UK and so on and so forth, and Ireland.
Are you shipping to worldwide?
No. Well, yes, we will ship everywhere. We distribute only in the US, and then, you know, from distributors they get to all the shops, but we will ship anywhere in the world. So, you know, going over Atlantic Ocean or Pacific Ocean, you're going to have to pay, we say, duties and shipping land on the purchaser. But, you know, put a big enough order in and it's totally worthwhile.
Yeah, just mark them as gift, Ted said, so it'll be fine.
I like it.
Ted King, you are a gent. You are, to use the phrase, the king of gravel.
Oh, man, I appreciate it.
Thanks for chatting, man.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Whoa, I could have sat there and listened to Ted King all night. What an interesting dude, the way he's transitioned and made a new genre of professional cycling. It's admirable, and I'm enjoying watching this space evolving. And yeah, it's going to be a super interesting space. Who knows, maybe instead of watching Paris-Roubaix in a couple of years, we'll be sitting back on the couch to watch Dirty Kanza. Who knows? Guys, if you enjoyed the podcast, please make sure you subscribe to it and make sure I can get these into your hands much easier. Share it on Instagram with a friend. It helps spread the good word. And like I said already, please, please, please jump on over to our Patreon, patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh, and buy me a coffee or a beer, and it just keeps this podcast show rolling. You wouldn't believe the guests I have hooked up over the coming podcasts. It's going to be epic. So stay tuned and make sure you don't miss the upcoming shows. Thanks, roadmen. Look after yourselves, and I'll see you on the road soon.